Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, well, welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. We are doing something a little different today. The first ever professional athlete on the show, Mr. Rich Franklin. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Hey, thanks. I am the first.
Yeah, first time I've ever had a professional athlete, and a three-time UFC middleweight champion is a good way to kick it off.
Well, I listen, it's a pleasure to be on the show, but that makes it even more of an honor, so thank you.
Yeah. Well, we've had plenty of, you know, best-selling authors and philosophers, but we've never had someone who is a professional athlete, and I think you'll do a good job, though. But we're not here to talk about mixed martial arts. We're not here to, talk about the intricacies of the UFC and what's going on there. I'm here to talk to you because a couple weeks ago, I heard your TEDx talk, and I was super impressed by it. It was really good.
I appreciate that. That's I've talked a few times in a couple different places. I actually, I think the first real talk I ever gave was at a church out in Maui.
To really? Be real honest.
Yeah, they brought me out to speak to their youth group and to seminar, and it was the first real talk that I'd ever given. But it was a very casual environment. And I've done a couple other talks that are like that, things that are like speaking to the school where I went, where I graduated from. I spoke to a wrestling tournament that they had one time and just simple little things like that. Of course, I have a background in teaching.
Yeah.
And so get up every day and you technically talk, but presenting a lesson is a lot different than actually giving a talk.
Yeah.
But TED Talk was actually the real first organized speech that I'd ever given.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was. And especially the first one. I mean, it was the first one, and it was the first one that I had to use things like PowerPoint and whatnot. So, and it was very, very tricky actually prepping for that, because the idea of the TED Talk is that you keep the talk under 18 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked him, I said, well, on the downside, like, what do you want on the short side of this thing? Like, you don't want it to be any less than, and they said, well, if you can keep it between 15 and 18 minutes, that'd be great. So in practicing and prepping for this speech, trying to hit that mark, it really I found to be quite challenging, because if I spent too much time on any one story, that could make me or break me. On top of the fact that when I was delivering the speech, they told me that they would actually have a timer on the stage for me on the teleprompter or whatever, and there was no timer when I got out there.
Seriously?
No, and so I was flying blind the whole time. And the one thing that I knew was that when I was telling stories, I had certain time marks in my head of places that I needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly when I started delivering, I thought, oh, well, this timer will kick on here in a minute, and they just haven't put it on yet, and it never
happened.
But which only added to my nerves, because several people prior to me had their slideshows all messed up and stuff like that. And I thought, oh, this could not go well before this is all done. But fortunately, they didn't make any technical errors in mine other than forgetting the timer. And I delivered well.
So yeah. You felt good about it afterwards?
I did. Considering I felt decent about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm my worst critic. People typically are. So when I came off stage, and my business partner attended, and the first thing I did was look to him for, okay, give me your constructive criticisms. That's what I need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I've been that way my entire athletic career. Like when I come out of the cage, I always want to hear the things I did wrong first, not the things that I did well, so that I could work on fixing those things. I'm just the kind of person that doesn't need a whole bunch of praise, but I need to fix the things that I didn't do well, as long as I know that I did at least a decent job.
Have you listened to the tape?
I did listen to it one time. And of course, me listening to it was terrible, because I'm pointing out like all the things that I did wrong as a speaker and things I want to work on, which has been a good exercise for me, because I frequently, once again, I'll speak at like military bases, and these are all just real casual kind of talks, but there are certain stylistic things that I've really begun to pay attention to from that TED Talk video that I watched that I'm beginning to work on now, that hopefully in the future will make me even more effective.
What's the one thing you're trying to work on the most?
Anchoring movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you watch effective speakers, everything that they do, I actually took a public speaking seminar from a Dale Carnegie course. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I need to work on, that watching other public speakers, is that they have what's called purposeful movement. Mm-hmm. That everything that they do has purpose and meaning, that they're just not haphazardly moving their hands around like when they're talking, and they're not swaying, and they're not. And one thing that I'm particularly bad about is when you get into a pacing routine on the stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the things that I work on.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the actual topic. Is that something you came up with, or was that given to you?
Ultimately, I ended up coming up with it. When my PR consultant basically like came to me with the idea of speaking for TED, at first it sounded up. I was on board right away. I'm like, great. I watched a lot of the TED talks.
You have some favorites?
I do. I really, if you've not seen the Benjamin Zander
talk,
I don't know what the actual title of it is, but it's about passion for music or how music affects us.
Yeah,
he's the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic Symphony. Great talk. He's quirky. He's funny. He's effective. He's passionate, and he's able to do all that in his talk. And he uses the piano too, so he keeps it very, very interesting. But no, it's a really good talk. But when my PR consultant had basically come to me with the idea about speaking to TED at a TED conference, at first I was like, absolutely, this would be a great idea. And then the gravity of that decision started to set in my head as to perhaps I shouldn't have been so quick to jump on. So I started like looking for ideas, and probably one of the worst things I could have done is watched other TED talks, because I went back and watched the Benjamin Zander talk again, and then that became my standard for performance. And it's one of the best TED talks I've ever seen. Yeah. So suddenly my measuring stick was so difficult to measure myself up to, and that became even more nerve-wracking for me. But as time went on, I had several people give me some ideas about things, and ultimately the concept of how to be a loser came to me, because these TED talks, they're idea-generated talks. It's basically looking at the world through a different scope, and I wanted something unique and something that really stood out. And so that title I came up with, and it's an attention grabber, definitely.
Yeah, it definitely worked for that for that very purpose. And I'm assuming some people look at you and go, well, you were like the apex of your profession. What do you really know about being a loser? Did you ever get some of that feedback?
No, not really, because I have losses in my career. And the whole point is that listen, losing is inevitable. You cannot avoid losing or failure in life. You're going to fail at something. And if you live a life where you don't ever experience failure, then I feel bad for you, because you've just set your goals too low.
Yeah.
If you succeed and accomplish everything that you've ever set out to do and have never at least experienced setbacks in that process, then the things that you have set out to accomplish are just too easy. And so you've seen athletes historically that have basically like lost a title or lost a championship or something like that, and then they just kind of fall off the face of the earth. One that comes to mind quickly for me is Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
Mike Tyson, after Buster Douglas beat him, like his career pretty much just was, that was it. That was the end of it. And I'm not saying that he is, that he doesn't know how to be a loser, so to speak.
Yeah.
But the point is that when failure or loss comes your direction, it's not about being a gracious loser. That's not what the speech was about. It's not about being able to pat your opponent on the back and say, hey, good job tonight, you were a better man than me. But it's about having the tools in your toolbox to be able to deal with a loss, deal with that loss, get rid of it, and then continue to move forward in a successful manner. And that's basically what the whole talk is about. And I've experienced that in my career because, well, for example, I've never lost two fights back to back. Whenever I've lost a fight, I've always gone back and evaluated things and then went back in and won my next fight. And so it's that kind of example, basically.
Yeah, well, you start your speech off and you tell about the night after the first Anderson Silva fight, which I'm sure it's a great memory for you, something you always want to talk about. But in your speech, you start off talking about that night. You're at the Mandalay Bay. You lose the fight, the first time your mom ever watched you fight in person. And so the whole night, you're sitting up in your room at the Mandalay Bay. You're watching traffic. Side note, on the other side of the country, I'm pastoring a church in Florida, and I'm a little bit of a Rich Franklin fan. Like,
well, thank you.
My old CrossFit coach might have played your intro song, the Hell's Bell song, before big workouts to pump me up. So
We're About to Rock.
Oh, We're About to Rock. That's right. Yeah. So
Mando. Yeah.
Yeah. So they play. Anyway. So I'm a little bit of a Rich Franklin fan, and you're up all night, discouraged, staring at traffic. Well, the next morning, I've got to get up and preach. And I remember having one of those flashbulb memories. I'm getting my slides ready, about to go on, and I'm thinking, I've got to tell people some good news, but I'm still depressed that Franklin lost last night. So I'm depressed on the other side of the country. You're depressed in Las Vegas. Tell me what you're feeling in that moment. You're up all night. What is the feeling that you have after you lost for the first time in probably a couple of years, and you're staring out, looking at the traffic? What are you feeling?
It's – I said this in my talk. I asked myself the three questions. You're in disbelief at first when you experience something like that. How did this happen? Why did this happen? And how do I fix it? Those are basically the three questions. And you don't have the answers because it's stuff. It just takes time. Mm-hmm. It really takes time. But I sat there, really sat there motionless, just staring out the window and watching that traffic go by all night. I sat there, and from the time that I got back after the fight that night and literally until the sun came up the next day in this chair. And mind you, like, I had to go to the doctor the next day. My nose was destroyed because I got kneed in the face. And yeah, I mean, you have the pain on top of everything. But, you know, how did this happen? Why did this happen? And what do I do to fix it? How do I fix it? This is over and over all night long. And basically, I didn't come to a conclusion. Like, I didn't come to a conclusion. And
are you trying to replay the fight, think about how you could do differently, or are you just feeling feeling embarrassment or shame or what?
Yeah, it's not just the fight. It's the training prior to, like, you start thinking about the entire process. Like, something had to go wrong somewhere for me. Mm-hmm. Somewhere. Of course, at that time, when you first lose, there's still a bit of pride, perhaps, and arrogance in your mind, and you're blind to whatever it is that could have caused the problem. But on top of that, yes, it's shame and embarrassment and all those kinds of things as well. Because I spoke about this in the talk as well, about prior to the fight, and literally, and I do this, and it's not just that fight. Like, I do this before every fight. People think like, because you're a world champion. Traveling with Mike Dolce recently to military bases and talking and stuff. And Mike made a statement one day about me, and he said, you know, he basically said, Rich Franklin was the middleweight champion of the world. And he said, there's 7 billion people on this planet. And he was one of 7 billion. Like, he set himself aside. And so when you think of that, it's like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
At the same time, with that, there's a lot of expectations and pressures and things like that. And when I talked about, I'm really just recapping everything I talked about in my talk. There was a point in my career where everybody else's opinion mattered to me. And then quickly, I just realized that not everybody else's opinion mattered to me. That what the casual fans were saying about me, that's not where the embarrassment or shame comes in. But the fact that I have to go home and my friends, I have to look at my friends, and my friends have to give you that shameful, like, hey, man, it'll be okay. Or they make excuses for why you lost or whatever. And you're just basically sitting there saying, no, I lost because I had a bad performance, or because I didn't do my job that night, or whatever the case may be. But just having to go home and face, like, your training partners, all the guys that helped you get ready for that fight, all your entire team, because you didn't just let yourself down, you let all these other people down as well. Hmm. And even though they won't tell you that, when you lose a fight, just like you said, you had to go into church the next day. When I lost that fight that night, you lost with me. And when you there's a point in your career when you realize that it's more than just everything is riding on you. That there are other people out there that this affects. People like your family, the people that love you, people that you don't know, that where they basically, like, they could have good days and bad days based on you winning and losing. Or one time I met a young man who was battling cancer and was talking about how much he looked up to me. And when you start putting things like that in perspective about how this person who has terminal cancer, that I'm their, basically their beacon of light. And then that night, that light was just, it went out.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure, man.
It is. And so you sit there and you're scratching your head, you know, and you really, really are asking, like, it's, you almost drift down that path of, God, why did you do this to me? You know, which is the new normal human reaction. Like, people are always like, as if God imposed this situation onto you rather than taking responsibility for it yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's naturally like you're sitting there like, how did this happen? What do I do to fix it? You know, and why did this happen? And the why did this happen, because I'm a Christian, comes down to a lot of times like, why did God allow this to happen? Or then that gets reworded into, why did you do this to me, God?
Yeah.
All these pressures that you feel with all these other people, you know, I run into people all the time that say, hey, man, I have people that are fans because I'm a good role model for their kids, or because I'm the epitome of hard work or work ethic or whatever it may be. Coaches that say, man, I used your such and such video for my high school football team or whatever. And then that night, you let everybody down.
Is it hard to have everyone projecting these unrealistic expectations onto you, saying, you know, you're the beacon of light, you're the paragon of hard work, and you're the all-American boy or whatever? That's got to wear you down trying to carry that mantle that people have put on you.
No, it used to. It used to be a really difficult thing to deal with.
How is it not anymore?
After you lose a couple times, you realize. The final point in my talk was about losing with the effort of a champion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of the problem, and I really did hit a depressive state after that loss. I was razor close to not bouncing back because I did not have the tools at the time to deal with the loss. I didn't know how to basically evaluate a situation. And then, you know, what I talked about in the TED talk. I didn't know how to evaluate the situation, use the useful stuff that I needed, and just disregard the rest. Like, I held on to that. I held on to that block that I was carrying around for some time, and it weighs you down. It slows you down, and so it took that loss for me to really evaluate things. And you realize that in the end, and when I said that at the end of my talk about losing with the effort of a champion. That when you really do go into a loss and you give it your all, like you really put everything on the line, you don't feel so bad about it. Because in my career, in the second half of my career, win or lose, whether I won or I lost, like people can always say, like, you know, Franklin, at least he went out there and like he fought his heart out.
Yeah.
You know, there was no like, yeah, that just wasn't. He wasn't giving it 100%.
Definitely. So you talk about in your speech the selective amnesia, which you just referred to, and you said you didn't have that, and so you've developed that skill, which kind of brings up a bigger question that people always seem to wrestle with when it comes to adversity. Is adversity something that gives you character, or is adversity something that reveals character? For you, what is your experience? Does it show you your character, or does it give you character?
Oh, absolutely. I actually have it gives you character. Well, adversity gives you character when you initially experience it.
Mm-hmm.
But after you've experienced it, that adversity will in turn show you character, show what your character is down the road.
Yeah.
But it is what truly gives you your character. I think I have I believe it's Romans 8:18 maybe, And it talks about Paul talking about the present day sufferings that we go to will not worthy in comparison to the glory.
Which yeah.
And so I have that written on my mirror. I actually write things on my mirror. A couple different verses, a couple different original quotes, and just different things that I write on my mirror with dry erase markers.
Yeah.
So when I get up in the morning, I'll look at the verses or look at the little quotes or the sayings, and occasionally I'll change them out. But that's one of the things that I have written on my mirror right now.
Huh. That's great. Well, you talk about one of the basic fears is failure. Obviously, no one wants to fail. There's research that shows that the fear of losing a dollar or any amount of money far surpasses the joy of winning. And so like this fear of failure is very real for us. And, you know, people often talk about that line, like, what would you do if you knew you never could fail? And there was another TED talk in which a lady named Brene Brown gave a beautiful speech. And elsewhere she says that a better question isn't what would I do if I knew I couldn't fail, but what would I do even if I knew I would fail at it? And in your speech, you touch on getting around this basic fear of failure. How do you think people can get away from that fear that often paralyzes us from not being willing to branch out, to try something new, to do something that would be uncomfortable for you?
Wow. Wow, man.
Well, here's the thing. Like you were obviously a teacher. You got a master's degree in education, undergrads in math. You have a steady, stable job. You leave education in a time in which mixed martial arts is not making the money like it's making now. I mean, it was not on pay-per-view, not on Fox. I mean, your fight with Shamrock on the first Ultimate Fighter finale was the very first free mixed martial arts thing on TV. And so you went in before there was Gatorade and Nike and Reebok sponsoring people. And so you obviously had to risk something to go into the world of mixed martial arts.
Absolutely.
So how did you get over that fear of, crap, I'm going to give up a good, stable job to do something in which I might get my face broken and make no money?
Yeah, you don't ever think about the I might get my face broken aspect of things.
See, I would, and that's why I'm not a fighter.
Yeah, well, and my face has been broken now, so – but at the time, I thought I was good enough to keep my face from getting broken. So
okay.
There's a little bit of ignorance on my part, and I think that is possibly what masked me from the fear a little bit. But yeah, honestly, I don't. In this world, there are people who have a higher tolerance for risk.
Yes.
Than others. And I think that your tolerance for risk will vary based on what it is that you're doing. For example, I just recently started a business out in L.A. I have a cafe, a juicery and a cafe out here in L.A. And there was a period in time where business was not going really well when we first opened for several months. And my business partner is he sat on the board of advisors for Hollywood Video and helped sell that company for over $1 billion and has been in just, you know, corporate retail his whole life. He's a business degree from Kellogg University. And this is the environment that these kind of people put themselves in. And there are a lot of things that are out of my circle of control in this scenario. And so you want to talk about somebody who is a nervous Nelly in dealing with business. I'm that guy.
Really?
I'm the guy who would be choked up. And I talked about the three levels of decision making, your best decision, your best choice, and the worst choice you can make is indecision. And I would be that guy who would be choked up on indecision for fear of failure or loss. Because this is not a realm in which I'm comfortable. And every day that we're working together on this business, I get more and more comfortable with setbacks and losses and all those kinds of things. And I think that honestly, that fear, it takes a little bit of experience. It really does. It takes some experience because prior to me losing that title, I was scared to death of losing my title. I was scared to death of the shame, of the embarrassment, yeah. Stuff that we talked about before. Fortunately, in that talk, I met that young man at Walter Reed Hospital, and sitting down and talking to him, you have to remember, you just have to basically put things in perspective. And one of the things that I tell myself is that if I was on my deathbed today, laying there and I had to say my final goodbyes to everybody, would this loss to Anderson Silva really matter? If my business went bankrupt today and I was on my deathbed tomorrow, would my business bankrupting really matter? Like, would it really matter? Like, because what really, really matters in life? And when you learn how to put things in perspective that way, it becomes much easier to take chances, because then you're able to step out of the security of this, you know, your circle of comfort. Basically, you have to step outside that circle of comfort. Now, you have to do that within a parameter of your circle of control.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to step out of your circle of comfort into a circle of things you cannot control. You have to be able to control things, but you have to learn what things it is that you can control, what things it is that you can't control, and then assess the situation of whether or not you're willing to step outside of that circle of comfort.
Yeah.
It just takes time and experience. It's not something that, like I said, certain people have a higher threshold for taking risk, but even still, it takes a little bit of experience, and whether it's your own experience or just witnessing others' experiences and being there as part of that process and understanding how other people can deal with that, you have to be part of that process, I believe.
That's good. And obviously one of the ways you get through that is experience, and you take your own licks, and you get that perseverance to keep going. And obviously sports is a great metaphor for that. And, you know, as you're transitioning, I think you're going to do one more fight. Is that right? You got one retirement fight, and then you're having to.
Yeah, I've won on my contract, and the plan is for that to be my retirement fight.
Yeah. And so then you're transitioning to a new phase of life, business. You obviously recently got a position with a new upstart mixed martial arts organization in Singapore. One Fight FC? Is that what it's called?
One Fighting Championship. It's One FC.
Okay.
So I have an executive role with that organization. And it's basically they're growing, but that's it's Asia's largest MMA organization. So, hopefully – I can do there what I did with the UFC and help this organization grow into some even larger.
Yeah. So as you think about risking and trying new things, obviously you've developed perseverance, you've grown as a person through fighting. And you know, one of the things that people wonder is, you know, is it harder to lose like a really close contest or to have a blowout? Like, you know, you have, you know, the guy who took the title from you, Anderson Silva, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years later, fought Chael Sonnen, was losing the fight for 4.5 rounds. And at the very end of the fight, he catches Chael Sonnen in a triangle or something, submitted him, right? Mm-hmm. And so that fight, Chael was winning the whole time. And at the very end, he loses. I mean, it's not Bill Buckner with the Red Sox, but it's a close thing in mixed martial arts in a championship fight. You're probably going to find as a guy who's dominating, definitely going to win. Do you think in times like that, it's harder to withstand losses, or a loss that's just an absolute blowout where you seem like you never even had a chance at the beginning?
For me personally, and I would imagine that most people are in this situation, but for me personally, it doesn't really matter.
Really?
Because going back to the original statement that one of the things we were originally talking about being your own worst critic.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are your own worst critic, you just pick out the worst possible scenario that something could possibly be. And so in a situation where it's a razor close, like you think about the example you gave with Anderson and Chael. And Chael was winning that whole fight, and he's been caught in triangles before in fights.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy Horn caught him in a couple, and I know Jeremy personally, and I remember seeing these fights. And so there had to be part of Chael that when he went home saying, I cannot believe I made that same mistake again. And when you think about it like that, like he can beat himself up over just that one error as much as if he would have just totally just dropped the ball the whole fight.
Yeah.
Either way, it's a mental block that you're going to have to let go of.
Yeah, I can't imagine having to stomach all of your career on one thing, everything that you work for, and it's just that one moment. Which as an athlete, you know, you have 3-4 months preparing for this one night, and then it's all on the line right there, and then you have to withstand. Things went your way or didn't go your way, and that's, you know, that's got to be hard.
It's difficult. My thought is this, and it's just a theory. I'm a fighter. I'm not a baseball player or any other kind of athlete for that matter. But I think about it like when you play a game of baseball, for the most part, if you mess up something in a game, you get to play a game like 2 days later.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of in your mind get to erase that mistake a little bit. Now, when you make an error in something like a major championship, when you're going for a pennant or something like that, like you can't just undo these things. But think about the fact that I train the amount of time that I train, like I basically put in about 200 hours of prep time for a 25-minute fight. For specifically, just for that fight, is the 200 hours of prep time for a 25-minute fight. It's a course of 8 to 10 weeks. And so for 10 weeks, I'm training for a single event. And football players, they get to play every week. And if they have a bad game, they kind of get to erase it the following week.
No.
I think about that for a fighter. And then I think about how much more difficult it would be for, in my mind, for, say, a track and field athlete who messed something up in the Olympics. Because nobody cares that you won, like, the European Open track and field games or whatever. Like,
there's one event, yeah.
Yeah, you can gold medal in all these – you were the Pan Am 100-meter gold medal sprinter and this and that and everything else. But then all of a sudden you show up on the Olympic stage and you mess that up, and guess what? There's your legacy.
Yeah. No, I get that. I was a pole vaulter in college, and I wasn't that good, but there was a girl that was came to college on a sprinting scholarship, and then I said, hey, you should be a pole vaulter, and she's picked it up. And within a year, she qualified for the Olympic trials in Sacramento, and this was, you know, 2000 or whatever. Well, she goes there with a stress fracture. First year pole vaulting, she qualifies. She's within, you know, 3 or 4 inches of being able to go to the Olympics, but she has a stress fracture, never is really able to ever get back to that mark again from that one moment. And you exactly. just, yeah, you don't get that second shot.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Olympics 4 years later, and by that time, things pass, you know, situations change, whatever it could be. So, yeah, you know, and she's in for some time, she'll live with that, or at least lived with that.
Yeah.
The regrets, the questions, how, why, and all that kind of stuff. But eventually, she'll learn to let that go. And yeah. I would imagine, like I said, I would imagine for Olympic athletes that it's – you only get that shot once every 4 years. At least I have, like – 2 to 3 shots a year to kind of correct things.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well, you're definitely right. This is a subject that everyone needs to learn. And I think you find in every, you know, spiritual tradition across the board is that there seems to be like two ways for people to grow. And one is the way of love and the other is the way of suffering. And obviously loss is a great example of suffering. And so I think your TED Talk is brilliant. I love what you're saying. And I highly encourage everyone to check that out. And, you know, this next phase of your life, your place in Beverly Hills. Tell us the name of again of that.
It's called Zeeland. My business partner's last name is Zeeby, and my last name's Franklin. So we just stuck the two together. Called it Zeeland, and it's an organic juice and fusion cafe is what we called it. We offer some cold pressed juices, fresh made juices, and some various other food items. Things like acai bowls. We have some gluten free and vegan and organic baked goods and. And just various other things. There's a lot of stuff in the shop, but it's a fun little shop. We were there yesterday. We're pretty much there every day.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then obviously you've got your retirement fight that's going to eventually happen one of these days. You don't have a date picked out or opponent or anything?
No, I don't. But I'm quickly approaching 40 this year.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've been in this game. My first fight in the UFC was in 2003.
Wow, that is a long time.
Yeah, so it's been a great long career, man. God, I've been blessed. I really truly feel like a blessed man. I've been able to do things and see things in this world that I otherwise would not have been able to do had I continued teaching high school.
Yeah,
and so you know, there of course that's a double edged sword, being able to do and see all these kinds of things, but no, it's. Yeah, it's been 10 years that I've been in the UFC. My first professional fight was in 1999. Of course, the sport was much different back then. You probably were in junior high or something. How old were you?
Well, actually, in 99, I was a freshman in college.
Okay.
But
listen, that's a compliment to you because you look young. So.
You know, you're not the first person to ever say that I look young. But no, in 99, I freshman in college, but 2 years before that, I was a high school wrestler in Southeast Ohio, and I think I saw like UFC 1 or 2. Somehow we got a DVD and or not DVDs, a VHS, and I watched it, and I was like, "Yes, this is great." And I was a wrestler back then. I thought, "Well, this is a great thing for wrestlers to do after you get done, because you know, there's no real career if you don't go to the Olympics.
Exactly. And even if you go to the Olympics, there's no real career.
No, there's no career in that.
Wrestling is like, that's one of the reasons why I admire wrestlers or people that do these obscure sports like that, because you basically go into this for the passion and love of it. And by the time, there has to be that moment that you're, when you're in college and you're going to classes and you're extending yourself and all this training, and you have to, there has to be that moment where you say, why am I doing this? Because once this college career is over and I'm not getting paid for it, this leads nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, how is this sacrifice worth it? But they continue without the promise of some glory at the end, or money, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these guys, but unlike, you know, guys that play college football or whatever, well, they know that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Exactly. Well, I was a pole vaulter and a wrestler, two obscure sports.
How does that happen?
That is a very good question. You have to be dumb to do both of them. You know, like, I'm going to get in a fiberglass stick and jump in the air, or I'm going to get in the mat and have someone choke me out or do the same to someone else. So
I just think of the posture that wrestlers have when they're shooting and stuff like that, and then picture you sprinting while doing that. And I don't see how you're getting down the lane fast enough to actually get over the bar with your pole vault.
Right? Yeah, well, you know, the one thing is it's the same outfit. You say the same outfit in both sports.
Well played.
Yeah, and so that's the commonality, but no. Okay, so I did when I was in 99, I interned at a church doing youth ministry. I've never done youth ministry except that summer and the summer after. And so if you say yes to this question, I get it as someone who has spent time working with adolescents. Did you decide, I'm going to leave being a math teacher and instead I'm going to get punched in the face for a living, because it's better to get punched in the face than deal with 15-year-old boys all day?
Well, first of all, let me say this. I thought that it would be a better idea to punch people in the face
okay,
than deal with 15-year-old boys all day long. I just knew that getting punched in the face was kind of...
That's the price you pay.
Yeah, exactly. It's just part of the job. However, and I tell people this all the time, I love teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I love math. When I fly on the plane, I like to sit down and do Sudoku puzzles and all that kind of stuff.
Did you just say, I love math? I don't think I've ever heard someone say that before.
And there ties in. That's exactly, you're making my point for me. I love teaching. I love math. I hate teaching math. Think about it for a second, and it makes sense, because you just made my point. I would, in a given year, have about 150 students, and with 150 students, if I had 5 students who genuinely enjoyed studying math, that was a pretty good year. Now,
jeez.
That means I have to, on a daily basis, come into a building and stand in a room and talk to 145 people about crap that they don't care about. And they're making those faces like, oh, gosh, do we have to learn this? And how do you come in and say, look, class, today we're going to find the foci of an ellipse, and trust me, it's going to be fun. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm a pastor, so I'm used to getting up to people who don't want to hear me talk and talking regardless. But I'm at least not talking about foci and ellipse and carrying the two over, whatever you're talking about.
Yeah, but I'll say this. At least if you're pastoring on a Saturday night or a Sunday morning or both or whatever it is that you do, people at least make the choice to come there every week.
Yeah, that's right. They don't.
So
yeah.
On some level, they want to be there. Now, granted, you have some of the kids that I'm talking about, those teenage kids that get dragged to church because their parents want to go, you have some of those in the audience. But overwhelmingly, the percentage of people who want to hear you speak.
Fair enough.
Otherwise, they wouldn't continue coming back to the church.
That's true. There are plenty of husbands, though, who are drugged by their wife to church that don't want to be there. And we all know that's the case.
I'm sure.
But you know, here's the thing, though. If I was able to be a fighter, then I'd at least intimidate him and say, if you don't pay attention, I'm going to fight you afterwards. But I can't do that, unfortunately.
See, what you need is to have people like me attending your church.
Well, Rich, you are more than welcome anytime you're around the Dallas area to come join me for a service, and you can be the intimidation in the back.
The next time I'm in Dallas, if I'm there on a weekend or whatever, I'll extend my stay. And stop by and visit the church on the Sunday.
Hey, sounds good. Last time I saw you in Dallas, you were fighting on the 103 card against Vitor.
Oh,
so hopefully it'll be a better stay than that time was in Dallas for you.
Yeah, definitely. Dallas wasn't good to me.
No, it was in the it was bad weather that night. But hey, Rich, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Big fan of your work. Keep up the good stuff, man.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the interview. It was a great interview.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.